From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We'll be going all over the map today, including to upstate New York, where undocumented immigrants are trying to draw attention to some poor working conditions.
But we start, Jeremy, in Nebraska. The legislature there is deciding in the next few weeks whether to officially repeal the death penalty. If they do, they'll be the first conservative state to do so in more than 40 years. The Tea Party-endorsed governor and many conservatives are still staunch supporters of capital punishment. But support is growing among a group of equally conservative state senators. Leading the charge is the bill's co-sponsor, State Senator Colby Koash, who's in Lincoln. Senator Koash, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And we should say Nebraska's state legislature is officially nonpartisan. People don't run on party lines, but you do describe yourself as a Republican. We know it's a very red state, normally one that sides with death penalty. So what is the case you make against it?
Well, myself and some of my conservative colleagues have come to the conclusion that a couple of things. One, the death penalty is a government program that, at least in Nebraska, we've been unable to implement in over 20 years. And so a lot of us ran on a good government, an efficient government platform. We said to people that if you send us to the state capitol, we will find and root out government inefficiency wherever we find it. And the death penalty seemed to fit that bill. It's something that's been on the books. It's not being implemented. It is costing our state money. And so we're approaching it, some of us, from a good government perspective and saying, look, this is a program that's not working. We should just get rid of it.
Well, but when you say you haven't been able to implement, are you talking about the number of appeals and the delays that are involved with death penalty cases?
Well, the appeals have been costly and have delayed any executions for about 20 years. We had to change our method of execution several years ago from the electric chair to lethal injection, which caused another round of appeals. Our state has been unable to procure the drugs needed. Our governor has indicated he has got some now, but those will end up in appeals. And at the end of the day, we've got inmates sitting on death row that I don't believe will ever be executed. And for that reason, it made sense to get rid of it.
We should say the Supreme Court is currently considering a lethal injection case, which is based on the drug that's currently being used that was part of that botched execution in Oklahoma last year. So you're saying all of these issues are tied up with some of your considerations. Is there anything else? Is there any moral or faith-based thinking?
Well, certainly a lot of people take their stance from a faith-based perspective. We're a very pro-life state. I consider myself pro-life, and I've always struggled with taking the life of anybody, whether it's an unborn child or through euthanasia or even the death penalty. And so I've tried to be consistent in my pro-life views and how that plays out into legislation. Mm-hmm. And some of my colleagues are doing that, and some are saying, this is just too expensive. And at the end of the day, I think we've got enough support to actually repeal it this year.
Well, this is an interesting moment here. You've got the very blue state, Massachusetts, in which a jury just delivered a death penalty verdict to the Boston bomber. You've got the purplish state, Colorado, which is now trying James Holmes, the accused Aurora shooter, and he is facing a possible death penalty. And then you've got your very red state there, considering being the first conservative state to ban it. Now, you know how some of your colleagues are viewing this. Senator Bill Kinter says you've lost your way as a conservative.
Yeah. He's a staunch proponent of the death penalty. I will tell you this. I've had a lot of conversations with victims' families, and I certainly don't speak for all victims' families when I say this, because there are families on both sides of the issue. But one of the things that I've said on the floor and I've said to Senator Kinter is, look, if the state imposes gives a sentence which it cannot carry out, how is that justice? If you talk to a victim's family and you say for the crimes committed against your loved one, the perpetrator is going to be put to death, and 20 years later, that sentence is still not carried out. My question is, how is that justice? As far as us losing our way, I still say that good government and efficient government is part of a core conservative value, and I'm standing behind that.
Well, your governor, Pete Ricketts, says a repeal of the death penalty puts the safety of the public at risk. But I'm wondering, there's a Pew report that shows that Republican support of the death penalty remains pretty unchanged, but conservative Republican support of the death penalty has dropped 7 percentage points in the last few years. Do you feel that there is some sort of a brush fire among conservatives going on, this combination of cost and the idea of taking a life? Do you think you're part of something bigger?
Well, I can't tell you if this is part of a bigger movement. I'm in my seventh year as a legislator, and I've advocated for the repeal since I've been here. And I think that every year that goes by that there is not a successful execution, it lends more and more credence to the idea that if we're not going to actually do this, then why do we need to have it on the books in the first place?
That's Nebraska State Senator Colby Cohash. He's behind the move to repeal that state's death penalty possibility. And if he's successful in the legislature, it will go to the governor, who has said he'll veto it. But then the legislature has a chance to overturn the governor's veto. We'll keep an eye on this. Senator Cohash, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, as part of his executive actions on immigration announced back in November, President Obama has said he would stop the deportation of some undocumented parents of U.S. citizens and permanent residents. And today was supposed to be the day that parents could apply to that program. But a federal judge in Texas issued a temporary injunction in February, and now many potential applicants are in limbo. It's estimated several thousand undocumented immigrants work on dairy farms in the Northeast. And farmers say they've become indispensable because Congress has failed to act on immigration reform and provide a legal visa program for the dairy industry. But earlier this month, farm workers and their advocates marched to the gates of Northern New York's largest dairy farm to call attention to what they call widespread wage theft, harassment, and other forms of abuse. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports.
Milk cows, not workers, about 40 people chant as they march up a gravel road past long rows of cow barns. They wave signs that read "No blood in milk" and "Say no to workplace violence." Some farmers, the protesters say, treat their cows better than the humans who milk them.
Tienen que tener dignidad para que los traten bien.
Workers should be treated with dignity, says Lázaro Álvarez, who's originally from Mexico City. Álvarez used to work here on Mark's farm, one of the state's largest dairy farms. According to farm officials, about 40 of its 55 employees are Hispanic. The Worker Justice Center of New York and the Worker Center of Central New York targeted Mark's farm for this march because of an incident under investigation by state police. The groups accuse a farm manager, Mike Tabold, of beating a worker named Francisco because he didn't want to work on his day off. Francisco was fired. Mark's Farm spokeswoman Lindsay Peck wouldn't comment on specifics because of the investigation, but she said the farm supports Tabold's actions and said Francisco violated an employee policy.
We have heavy equipment, large animals, there's a lot of activity going on, and we do have an absolute zero tolerance for drugs, alcohol, and any other questionable behavior.
To our fellow workers working on this farm, Jose Cañas shouts into a megaphone as the marchers line up facing Mark's Farm's front door. Facing back at them, two farm representatives lean against a car. Curious cows peer out from the barn.
Que denuncien los atropellos. Que denuncien las injusticias.
Report the beatings, report the injustices, the abuses, the racism, shouts Cañas. Don't be afraid.
No tengan miedo, compañeros trabajadores.
Advocates say it's not the first time workers have complained about Mark's Farm. But Rebecca Fuentes of the Workers Center of Central New York says it's about more than this farm. On many farms in New York State, she says, abuse of workers is common. Things like poor and unsafe housing, ignoring health problems, physical and verbal abuse, failure to pay minimum wage, and wage theft.
When workers don't get paid for all the hours, or they don't get paid at all, or they don't get the last paycheck, for these workers who are supporting their families, every dollar counts.
Yeah, the immigration situation in this country does pose challenges for both the farmers as well as for the farm employees.
Steve Ammerman is spokesman for the New York Farm Bureau, which lobbies on behalf of New York's 5,000 dairy farms. He says workers should report any kind of substandard work condition. But he says farmers bristle at the suggestion that abuses are common.
The overwhelming majority of the dairy farms, they take good care of their employees because they have to. They need them. Their farms wouldn't exist without them. And they could lose a worker just to another farm down the road if they weren't doing what's right.
No todas las fincas son iguales. Hay diferencias.
Lázaro Álvarez, the guy who used to work here at Mark's Farm, says it's true. Not all farms are the same. He says he's found better conditions on a farm a couple hours south of here. The marchers deliver a protest letter to Mark's Farm and call for the supervisor under investigation to be let go.
Fire the supervisor who assaulted Francisco.
Fire him! Fire him!
The farm workers say they want to work on these dairy farms, and the farms need them to milk the cows. The protesters say they should be able to do so safely and fairly. For Here and Now, I'm David Summerstein.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's tonight's top 10 list. Let's try this.
David Letterman, he has been doing the top 10 lists on his program for almost 30 years, first on NBC's Late Night, then on The Late Show on CBS. And tomorrow night, as we know, he will retire from The Late Show. But NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has come up with his own top 10 list, David Letterman's top 10 moments of all time. Eric, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's get right to it with your number 10.
Number 10 is average people used as sidekicks. David Letterman loved to use average staffers, stage managers, cue card guys as sidekicks. And one of his best sidekicks was Biff Henderson, stage manager, who he sent to more than a dozen Super Bowls. Let's check it out.
Now let's go into the locker room and celebrate. Way too many naked dudes in there.
Now, what I love about this is Letterman's whole mantra is anybody can do this, and TV is best when it's silly and stupid, and this is the epitome of that.
Okay, and number nine.
Number nine, David Letterman working part-time at a Taco Bell. He took over the drive-thru of a Taco Bell, and this is what
really?
Happened.
Really?
A medium Diet Coke.
Medium relative to what?
Between the small and the large.
Okay, check. We got it. We can do that. Right. I got that.
Okay, so he's the everyman.
He is the everyman. And also, Letterman has a great respect for TV history. Some of his inspirations were Steve Allen. And I think this comes from Candid Camera. You know, this idea that something average could become this hugely comedic and really silly kind of experience.
All right, number eight.
David Letterman is submerged into a tank of water wearing a suit covered in Alka-Seltzer pellets. Here he talks about it.
And we have the oxygen here, and I have been asked about 12 times by various members of the staff to remind you, don't try this at home. I know you have the 900-gallon tank. I know you have the oxygen. I know you have the suit of Alka-Seltzer and a staff of 100 people. No!
So when I spoke to Letterman last week, he told me that they actually tested this stunt with a writer from his staff. And then they realized that there was a problem with having somebody in an Alka-Seltzer suit. So let's check it out.
So now he's got water up to here, and it's all foaming and foaming and foaming. And whatever the active agent in the Alka-Seltzer is, it is removing the oxygen from the immediate surrounding. And he can't now. He's suffocating.
So basically, he's describing they tested the Alka-Seltzer suit stunt, and they realized the guy couldn't breathe when he was in the seat of Alka-Seltzer, so they had to give Dave oxygen when he did it.
I can't believe that he would remember that one stunt out of all of the ones that he has done over the years that they all stick in his mind, but there it is. And Eric, let's move on to number seven.
Okay, during a 1995 appearance on The Late Show, Drew Barrymore does a little dance, and she reveals a little something of herself to David Letterman. So this was great. It was Dave's birthday, so she gets up on the desk and does a little dance and then lifts up her shirt so only he can see what's underneath. She's not wearing a bra. And Letterman told me last week that that was one of his best experiences on the show, so there you go.
And we're not playing any tape of that, of course, because it wouldn't make any sense on the radio. And if we were television, we wouldn't play it either, probably, because there would be some problems
with
that.
You just have a black bar,
there we go.
You know, right
that's right. There's number seven. And by the way, we're speaking with Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. We're going through his favorite moments from David Letterman over the years. And Eric, let's get to number six.
Well, number six needs a little bit of context. So for listeners who don't remember, in 2009, David Letterman openly admitted to his audience that he had had affairs and that someone had tried to extort him for millions of dollars. And then he went on the show and talked about it in public. Here's a moment from that.
I have had sex with women who work for me on this show. Now, my response to that is, yes, I have. I have had sex with women who work on this show. And would it be embarrassing if it were made public? Perhaps it would. Perhaps it would, especially for the women.
So what's interesting about this is one of Dave's talents is that he can face the camera and talk about serious subjects in a way that's very compelling and that also keeps the audience on his side. And it was amazing that he went on the air and essentially admitted that he had had multiple affairs with women who work on his staff. He was married at the time. And instead of coming off as a cad, people were sympathetic. And as you could tell, they were even laughing at him.
Yeah, they were applauding.
Yeah, yeah. And now I had a listener get in touch with me when my Letterman coverage aired to say, you know, why is Letterman being treated so well when he's admitted to stuff like this? But I would say, in opposition to other people who may have admitted things like this, he fully admitted it. He did take responsibility, and hopefully he's changed his ways. I think there's a sense that he learned a lot from that experience.
Well, and it certainly didn't weigh down his reputation very much. It's not something that everybody's talking about now as he retires.
Exactly. And I think part of it was taking the responsibility and admitting and sort of talking about it publicly in a way that a lot of people don't when they're at the heart of a scandal. Mm.
Okay, let's get to number five.
Okay, so in 1986, after years of trying, Letterman finally gets Cher on his show as a guest, and let's listen to what happened next.
I thought that I would never want to do this show with you.
Now, why? Now, let's explore this a little. Why? Because you thought I was a...
So Cher, what I like about this moment is that David Letterman pushed his guests often to have very real reactions. So if he knew somebody didn't like him, or if he didn't like that person, or if he felt there was something they didn't want to talk about, he would push and push and push them until he got like a real reaction from them. So Cher calling him the A word fed into that and was a good example of that.
Well, and I remember also David Letterman with Madonna. We played a little clip of that last time you were on the show. Sort of an awkward exchange, but he has an interesting relationship with some of these celebrities. Let's get to number four, which is right on, in this theme, Eric.
Yeah, exactly. So when I talked to Letterman last week, I asked him about some of his favorite moments, and he talked about when Joaquin Phoenix came on and sort of pretended that he was quitting acting and acted like he was under the influence of something and seemed really out of it. And, we have some words here from Letterman describing how he felt about it.
Stuff like when Joaquin Phoenix came on, I just loved it. I thought that was great. That was a bit reminiscent of Andy Kaufman. I loved it when Andy Kaufman would come on. It was just fantastic. And unusual. And
now, Dave has a reputation also of bringing on guests like Andy Kaufman and Joaquin Phoenix, who are doing things that seem legitimate and real, but really are elaborately staged pranks. And so Joaquin Phoenix, Dave kind of knew that he was pulling something there. And also, Andy Kaufman came on and had a fight with a wrestler that looked very real, but really it was all planned out. And Letterman told me last week that every time Andy Kaufman was on his show, every stunt was meticulously planned out. They knew exactly what was going to happen, but they made it look spontaneous.
It's interesting he says that now because he looked very puzzled when Joaquin Phoenix was on acting so weird.
Yeah, well, maybe he's a good actor.
Okay, let's get to number three, Eric.
So anybody who watches Letterman's show will know about this one, the stupid pet tricks.
What are you guys going to do for us tonight, Abe?
Well, Sparky's going to act like a dog possessed by the devil.
Whoa. Wow.
Sparky, where's Satan? Where is he? Where's Satan? Where is he? Where is he?
crazy.
Now, what I love about this stuff is that Letterman, it seems to be admitting, like every talk show used to have animal acts come on. But Letterman is the only one who admits, okay, we know this is stupid, but it's still fun. So he called it stupid pet tricks. And then he had people come on and he called them stupid human tricks. So
right. It's
that balance of sort of Letterman saying, look, I know this is stupid, but it's still fun and we're going to do it and we're going to enjoy it.
Stupid pet tricks at number three. Eric, let's get to the top two here. Number two.
Okay, number two is Dave returned from heart surgery. So in 2000, Letterman had quintuple heart bypass surgery, and he had an emotional return to a show after weeks of guest hosts where he cracked a lot of jokes about the surgery. He talked about his surgeons and introduced them and thanked them, and he also had a special appearance from Jerry Seinfeld.
What are you doing here? What's going on? What's wrong?
What are you doing here?
I'm doing a show. I'm doing a TV show here.
I thought you were dead.
So again, now Letterman had a history of heart disease in his family, and I think in the back of his mind he always thought that it was a strong possibility he might drop dead one day. So the fact that he was able to have this bypass surgery and then go back to his life was really important to him, and he talked about it on the 8th anniversary of the operation, and he's been talking about it now that he's going off the air.
All right, Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. We have one more, your number one moment from over the years from David Letterman. What is it?
Yes, a little drum roll. And it's David Letterman's first show after the terrorist attacks on 9/11. He once again faced the camera and gave a very emotional speech about what New York had been through during those attacks. Here's a moment from his monologue.
It's very simple. There is only one requirement for any of us, and that is to be courageous. Because courage, as you might know, defines all other human behavior. And I believe, because I've done a little of this myself, pretending to be courageous is just as good as the real thing.
Now, when I talked to Letterman last week, he tried to shrug off these moments, saying, well, all I did was look at the camera and tell you what I was thinking. But it's a mark of a great broadcaster that he can be funny, he can be serious, he can be compelling, all in the same moment. And that's why we're going to miss Dave.
Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, talking with us about David Letterman, who is wrapping up his time at The Late Show. Tomorrow, we will link you to Eric's list of the top 10 moments of David Letterman at hereandnow.org. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And as some of you know, and some may be stunned to learn, there are still two states where you can't pump your own gas, New Jersey and Oregon. And now both are considering doing away with their decades-old bans. In Oregon, there's a proposal to allow self-serve in some rural counties. And in New Jersey, two state lawmakers are pushing to give all gas stations the option of self-serve. And a lot of drivers don't even know how to do it. Larry Higgs is commuting reporter for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. Larry, you've got some proud bumper stickers there?
Yes, we have. If you go to the Jersey Shore and you go to one of those touristy shops on the boardwalk, you can buy a bumper sticker that says "Jersey girls don't pump gas," and I've seen them on cars. So it's kind of a point of pride among some people. One of the commentators to one of my stories said, "In Jersey, we pump fists, not gas."
It's amazing. So native son Bruce Springsteen cannot pump his own gas in New Jersey. Nobody can. And we're reading that this ban started because of a fear of gas being flammable, but now pretty much everyone knows how to pump safely. So why did the ban continue?
30 years ago, there was an attempt to try to reverse the ban. And basically, there was a group of independent gas station owners who fought it. Their contention was big oil was behind it. In fact, they just put out a press release today saying that they support repealing the ban. And here's why. One of the things they say is that the big oil companies have gotten out of the gas station business. There are still Exxons and Sunocos and what have you out there, but they're run by franchisees and not the company directly.
Could it also be that even these small gas station owners in New Jersey are worried about having to pay those workers that they once wanted to hold on to? There was a lawsuit over wage violations in New Jersey years ago that, you know, the claim that they weren't paying workers enough.
Right. Well, here's the thing. We got the Department of Labor to give us an estimate. And as of May 2013, they estimated that slightly more than 10,000 people are employed as full-time gas attendants. Their average wage is about $9.50. When we spoke to the head of the local gas station owners association, and I brought that issue up to him, he basically said that self-serve, in his opinion, is not going to take away anybody's job because you have gas stations that have gas pumps that are basically not open. Mm-hmm. You know, there are traffic cones in front of them, and customers are filed over to the gas station pumps that have an attendant. What he's saying is it would open up more pumps. And the other thing is that full serve is not going away. In other words, if this becomes law, it's not mandatory.
Well, meanwhile, Larry, what are you hearing about people in New Jersey about possibly bringing self-serve in?
It is a very mixed reaction. You have the people who want convenience. They want the ability to jet in, pump their own gas, and get out as soon as possible, also part of the Jersey lifestyle. I'm getting a lot of concern from senior citizens and handicapped drivers who basically have said, look, I'm not capable physically of pumping my own gas. What's going to happen to me? And in talking to State Senator Gerald Cardinale, one of the sponsors of the bill, he said that provisions have been made for them. They basically will get full-serve gas at a self-serve price. So they won't be forced to get out of their car.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens there in New Jersey. We'll keep an eye on Oregon as well. Larry Higgs, a commuting reporter for the Star-Ledger in New Jersey. Larry, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Lawmakers from both parties are praising the U.S. raid that the government says killed a key ISIS leader over the weekend in Syria. Delta Force commandos slipped across the border from Iraq to conduct the operation, which targeted a man known as Abu Sayyaf. Derek Harvey is director of the Global Initiative for Civil Society and Conflict at the University of Southern Florida. He's with us from Washington. And Derek Harvey, tell us more about Abu Sayyaf. Who was he exactly?
Well, he was a mid-level financial administrator, leader of the Islamic State, focused on his activities in the oil arena in southeast Syria.
How important was he to ISIS?
Well, mid-level leaders are reasonably replaceable. He was important, I think, for the most part, because of his connectivity to the financial networks and the information that he had about the command and control within the Islamic State.
What about his wife, who was captured?
We understand that his wife was intimately involved in some of the hostage activities as well as apportioning the distribution of the prisoners, particularly women from northwest Iraq, particularly Nineveh province.
Do you think it makes sense to have the United States going in and doing a raid like this for a person you describe as a mid-level leader?
Well, I think it's very important to do a raid like this, not because he was a mid-level leader, but because of the thumb drives, hard drives, computers, telephones, and the records that the Islamic State meticulously keeps. Keep in mind that back in the days of the surge in Iraq in the first place, we conducted a raid into Syria in which we gathered a great deal of information and extremely beneficial knowledge about the Al-Qaeda in Iraq network that allowed us to take action against multiple levels of the organization. Without that information gained from the intelligence-driven operation, we would not have been as successful.
But there are risks. What if one of the Special Forces commandos were injured or killed in a raid like this? The American people wouldn't have tolerated the idea that after President Obama had said we're not going to have boots on the ground in Syria, that there were indeed boots on the ground in Syria.
I think he's calibrated his comments to give him the wiggle room to conduct direct action raids in and out, but we're not going to maintain combat boots on the ground. He has clearly stated, I think, in the administration policy is that we will conduct raids not just in Syria, but in Yemen, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere when the value of the raid, the target, and the risk are assessed as being, at the end of the day, beneficial to the United States.
You are correct in that, and I want to play exactly what President Obama has said, and starting with his first declaration. Here it is.
The resolution we've submitted today does not call for the deployment of U.S. ground combat forces to Iraq or Syria. It is not the authorization of another ground war like Afghanistan or Iraq.
And this was back in February, by the way, when he was asking for another authorization for the use of military force against ISIS. Let's listen to the part that you're talking about that he said after that.
For example, if we had actionable intelligence about a gathering of ISIL leaders, and our partners didn't have the capacity to get them, I would be prepared to order our special forces to take action because I will not allow these terrorists to have a safe haven.
So how do you draw that line there between having boots on the ground and having a war and having it escalate into a situation like Afghanistan or Iraq and just sending in special forces here and there to conduct these operations?
Well, I think, first of all, with the Abu Sayyaf raid, it was driven by the belief that they would get a treasure trove, as they've already stated with spokesmen. They said they got a treasure trove of information. You can only get that if you put boots on the ground and conduct a raid, gather the materials, and you leave. You could do strikes against individuals and groups by air or with drones, but that doesn't give you the information. And if we're going to win this campaign, you have to gather more intelligence. This is a hard target because we don't have 160,000 troops on the ground. We've got a lot of no-go areas, so you need to be very precise and aggressive in going after key intelligence when you can get it. To your second point, Jeremy, when you increase the tempo and presence of ground combat operations, at a certain point, you're going to shift from a direct action, limited operations, calling in air support, to a more broader direct action, day in, day out ground campaign. We're nowhere close to anything like that with troops on the ground. What we have is about 6,000 contractors, civilians, and military personnel on the ground in Iraq today. And they're primarily doing training, building, and assisting, some intelligence. And some are embedded with some Iraqi units, particularly the Special Operations Forces, and they're calling for fire, providing intelligence support and targeting support. That's a long ways away from having troops on the ground fighting in cities or in the villages around Ramadi or in Tikrit or places like that. They're being very careful about making sure that they don't take losses on the ground.
That's Derek Harvey, a retired Army colonel and intelligence officer who is now the director of the Global Initiative for Civil Society and Conflict at the University of Southern Florida. Derek Harvey, thanks again.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here.
And joining us now is Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of California. He's the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Schiff, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be with you.
And you were actually briefed on this raid before it happened. Did you have concerns about it?
Well, the briefing before was very abbreviated, really just given a heads up about what was about to take place. The questions that I've raised since the raid, and hats off to the Delta Force personnel involved in a really courageous effort and a successful one, is there were very considerable risks here. If one of our people were captured and killed, you can imagine what the potential for escalation would be. And I think we have to make sure that we ask the tough questions, even when raids are successful, that we would ask if they weren't. And that is, do those risks, are they nonetheless outweighed by the intelligence that we hope to gain? We're exploiting the materials that we got. They're very substantial materials, and it may very well prove to be worthwhile. But I'm going to reserve judgment until we see just what we've got.
But in general, would you say that it is a good idea for the U.S. to be sending special forces into Iraq and Syria, even though the president has said he doesn't want boots on the ground? Now, as we just heard a minute ago, he did make an exception for a case like this. But do the rewards outweigh the risks, especially with concerns about the U.S. getting more and more involved in this fight against ISIS?
I think the rewards have to be very considerable to be worth the risk. So if we're going after a very high-value target, or we're going after a target that possesses really keen intelligence that can help us in very significant ways, it may very well be warranted, and that certainly could be the case here. But we do have to think about just the potential for things going wrong and what that would mean. We saw with such a horror what ISIS did to that Jordanian pilot that they burned alive. And you can imagine what the reaction would be in the United States if we had a similar calamity. So I think we do have to be careful. It was a bold call by the president. It may very well prove to be the right call, depending on what we ascertain from the intelligence. And it's important, too, to determine what did we think we were going to obtain, because the fact that we may not have gotten everything we wanted shouldn't mean that necessarily it was the wrong call. But I think we need to look at both the expectations and the reality of what we were able to get here.
Of course, this operation did not happen in a vacuum. It's happening just as ISIS has taken control of Ramadi in Iraq. Do you believe that the U.S. should get involved in retaking Ramadi from ISIS?
I think the loss of Ramadi is a serious setback, and I don't think we should sugarcoat it. It's part of the story we've seen in the war in Iraq, and that is it's been a seesaw phenomenon. I think on the whole, we have shrunk the territory that ISIS controls, but nonetheless, they remain a very potent fighting force. But I think, notwithstanding the seriousness of the setback, we have to be careful that we don't draw the wrong conclusion. And I think the wrong conclusion is that the answer is sending an American boots on the ground. The right answer, I think, is we have to do more to press the Iraqis to make the Sunnis a real part of the military, a real part of the governance, a real part of the country, because right now what has driven the Sunni tribes into the arms of ISIS is feeling that they're marginalized, feeling that they're at risk from the Shia militias. And now the other wrong answer, drawing on these Iranian-backed Shia militias to come and try to liberate these Sunni areas, that risks strategic loss, even as we try to get a tactical gain.
That's Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
When you think about a tech hotbed, you think hackathons and hoodies in Silicon Valley, right? Washington, D.C., with its suits, paneled hearing rooms, not to mention the botched rollout of healthcare.gov, not so much. But as other tech hubs are looking to disrupt industries, shake things up, and then deal with how they get regulated later, D.C. techies are working from the inside, and there are a lot of them. Let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. That can only mean that someone from Recode is here, and it's Amy Schatz, senior editor of Tech Policy. She's out with a week-long series on D.C. tech. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how's it going?
It's good. And D.C. tech does seem like an oxymoron, the two words that don't go together. So remind us, because you do. You talk about a company called America Online. I mentioned that to someone, and they said, "What's that?" And I said, "It's AOL." So remind us of some of the history.
That's just a dagger in the heart of AOL's founders. Yeah, you know, the internet was partially, you know, came about because of DC, not just because of the funding from DARPA, which is defense defense research. They mm-hmm. they kind of fronted the money, but also because of America Online, which back in the day actually got Americans onto dial-up internet service mm-hmm. and the whole "you've got mail" and everything. And it actually that came from the suburbs of Washington, out in Virginia. And since then, you know, AOL was bought and sold, and it's now being purchased by Verizon. But you know, in the years since then, DC has actually become a bit of a tech hub itself. It's not as big as Silicon Valley, but it does have quite a few tech companies and tech workers here.
Well, you remind us, 79 of every 1,000 jobs in the Washington metro area are in tech. That's from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and a lot of them are young.
Exactly. You know, DC has actually led the nation in the number of millennials who have been moving into these parts here, about 12,000 a year over the last few years, which is a huge sum of millennials coming in. And also the other thing that DC has going for it is also that a lot of the people here come with college degrees. The DC region actually leads the nation in the number of people with college degrees. About half the population here has that. And so you have a very talented, educated workforce, a lot of young people. And that sort of has helped, you know, a lot of these companies sort of find talent and start working on new right. technologies.
Well, and talk about the other thing that seems so important about being in the Washington, D.C. area. You look at a company like Uber in San Francisco, starting there, and their model was the usual one: break into a market, disrupt it, and then figure out, you know, how, you know, you might be regulated after you have had a huge success and people need to have you around. Talk about the tech industry in D.C. and regulation.
Yeah, you know, that's worked pretty well for Uber, at least for a while in some parts, where you go in and you just kind of do what you want and then you apologize later. That's a little harder for other companies. And they've discovered that, you know, in some ways they do need help in D.C. They do need to make sure that they don't run afoul of regulators. I think that's something that happened with another startup, really hot startup in Silicon Valley called 23andMe, which was a DNA checker. Mm-hmm. And you could kind of check your DNA and see if there are other people out there who had your similar DNA. And they were doing great until all of a sudden the FDA put the whammy on them and they had to sort of shut down and stop marketing. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's something that for companies and startups who want to disrupt new industries that are heavily regulated, like, you know, healthcare and food, you know, it's hard to ignore DC, and it's important to try to at least get some buy-in from regulators here.
Yeah, to be there to help influence them. Well, what else is going on here? Are these different kinds of techies? It's a very Washington, D.C. is a very, sometimes people are shocked. Sure, it has an arts culture there and a population that lives, you know, in the way maybe young people live in other cities. But it's a very formal company town.
It is. It's a very risk-averse place. And that's been a problem, I think, for the tech industry out here, in that it doesn't sort of attract the same kind of people who might be attracted to an Austin or a New York or a Boston. It tends to be more the student class president types and the very sort of I want to change the world types. And that, you know, creates very different kinds of startups. There's an incubator in downtown D.C. called 1776. And the whole idea there is that they have is to help companies who are not just trying to make money, but also change the world. And that's something that you don't necessarily hear a lot of in other tech hubs.
Yeah. And what else is there in Washington? It would seem obvious. There's the huge security industry. It would seem like there are opportunities for techies in D.C. there might not be elsewhere.
You know, it's been very interesting because most of Silicon Valley is pretty unhappy with the Obama White House in Washington because of the NSA and because of the mass surveillance. Whereas for D.C. techies, it's actually been a huge boon because it allows them to have jobs at an enormous number of security contractors and government contractors. And those who get these high security clearances, they can actually make, you know, thousands of dollars more than they would in any other job, even doing relatively mundane IT kind of things. And so it's been a huge boon for the industry in that there's a lot of tech workers here working at these government contractors.
That's Amy Schatz, senior editor of tech policy at Recode, with her look at the booming tech population community in Washington, D.C. So, Amy, perhaps new grads should go east.
Exactly.
If they haven't already. Yeah.
Plenty of jobs.
Yep. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and I'm sure we've got listeners in, Las Vegas and New
Austin.
York and Austin and L.A. all saying, wait, but we're the tech hub. This is Here and Now.